From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
The Mission District.
Noe Valley.
I live in Silver Terrace.
Coming up, Golden Gate Park gets all striped up. We'll see what bicyclists have to say about it.
This is one of the dumbest things I ever saw, that they put these stripes down here.
Then we hop off our bikes and head to the airport to catch a flight.
Airports are ugly, some very ugly. Some attain a degree of ugliness that can only be the result of a special effort.
Does SFO qualify? Maybe not the new Terminal 2, which we'll look at through an artist's lens.
I'm walking through security and I look up and I see there are three shapes cut through the roof. And you can see the sky.
Calling all passengers on flight 124 to Cross Currents, we are now boarding.
The streets of San Francisco are changing. There are separated bike lanes off Market Street, green paint all over the wiggle. The city's definitely becoming more bicycle friendly. After many delays, the city's bike plan is well underway, with city streets long designed for car traffic being reconfigured for other modes of transportation. 4 years ago, the city had 45 miles of bike lanes. Today, there are 65, and more are scheduled to be laid down. And 75 more miles of streets will be stenciled with symbols designating them as bike-friendly routes. It's all having a big impact. According to the San Francisco Bike Coalition, bike trips have increased more than 70% since 2006. But one of the planner's choices hasn't been implemented so smoothly, and it's flat out rankled many of the bicyclists it's supposed to serve. KALW's Raisu Sussman and Ben Trefney report.
I've been biking around San Francisco for about a decade now.
Me too. Downtown.
West Side.
Mission District.
Ocean Avenue.
Pretty much all over.
So when the city decided to put together a big bike plan, I was pretty psyched.
Yeah, they said it would change the way San Francisco got to work. And after some legal slowdowns and an environmental impact report, they rolled it out. Green bike lanes on Market Street.
More bike parking all over the place.
Sharrows.
What?
You know, share the road arrows. They're those little stencils of bicyclists along the city's better bike routes. The ones with the little pointy arrows on top.
Oh, right, yeah. The ones that look like a Cub Scout badge for biking.
Yeah, sharrows.
All right, and then the striping of Golden Gate Park. Last spring, I talked with Leah Shame about that project. She's the executive director of the San Francisco Bike Coalition.
And what this means, roughly, is that imagine the parking lanes that are there kind of being moved out more into the center of the street, and the bikeway, the dedicated bikeway, will be against the curb or against the green space or the sidewalk area, so that people biking actually have that physical separation from the moving traffic. And JFK Drive was, we think, a great place to try this because it's way wider than most streets in San Francisco, so there was room there to try something different.
Something different.
Like an experiment.
Right. An experiment on a road I bike at least once a week.
I used to love biking down JFK Boulevard. It was really wide. It was like you owned it.
Yeah, honestly, I don't think it had many stripes whatsoever. But now it's full of them. So if you're looking down the street, on the far right side, there's a bike lane. Next to that, there's a lane for parking.
But in between those two, there's a buffer zone. The SFMTA...
That's the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency.
They say that the buffer zone needs to be at least 3 feet wide.
So bicyclists won't get doored by passengers who are getting out of the right side of their cars.
Yep, so bike lane, buffer zone, parking lane...
And then this one narrow lane for the cars heading down the road.
That's half of it. And then there's the traffic coming in the other direction and parked cars on that side and another buffer zone and then another bike lane.
That's a lot of new striping. Nearly $450,000 worth for the 1.5 miles that they did it on. And the MTA's told us that it was more than that in planning. So, Raisu, you talked with some people in the park to see what they think of this whole thing.
I did. And we're going to hear from a few of them, starting with this guy who stopped while driving his car down JFK Boulevard.
My name is Jimmy.
Jimmy, can you give me your first and last name and where you live?
I live in San Francisco, and my name is Harris.
Jimmy Harris?
Yes. And I think this is one of the dumbest things I ever saw, that they put these stripes down here.
Can you give me your name, first and last, please?
Nick, and it's Sheremetyev. I live actually in Daly City. I ride
So, but I also drive. Mm-hmm. And I think from a driver's standpoint, it's pretty bad. And parking is kind of intimidating and weird.
Then there's this couple.
Oh, Elizabeth Jones, and we live in Concord.
Frank Jones, we live in Concord.
It was a little confusing. It did confuse us a little bit.
Well, we did pull up and stop behind somebody, and we thought they're not moving. Then we realized there was nobody in the car, so we went around them.
All right. Hey, Resu.
Hey, Ben Trefney.
So you and I have come and met here in Golden Gate Park at the corner of JFK and what is that called? Music Concourse?
Right across from the hot dog stand.
And that's in front of the DeYoung Museum. So we pulled the newsroom and we said, what's an average car? And what we decided on was the
Toyota Corolla.
And here we have a Toyota Corolla. So anyway, what I was thinking, Resu, is that we could pull out a measuring tape and we could measure how wide the dimensions of these different things are, because I think that'll help us get some grounding in how big things maybe need to be in order for it to really work on a practical level.
But also, we should measure the Toyota Corolla, and then we should measure that big SUV up there to see how much wider it is.
That's a good point. All right, so let's go ahead and we could park your bike, and I've got my measuring tape out here right here, and we're going to go ahead and do some measurements. So the size of the parking space. Okay, yeah. You take this side. Watch out for cars because there's not a lot of room over there. And we've got the size of this parking space here is approximately 80 inches, which that's about six and two-thirds feet. Okay, let's measure this Corolla that's right here. Okay, the Corolla is just over 5 feet. I've got 5 1/4 feet. So maybe even kind of looks slightly small compared to these
it
other cars.
It looks small. It's maybe an older model.
Yeah. This particular one is about 5 1/4 feet. That means that they have about maybe a foot and a half, roughly maybe a foot and a half of wiggle room in where they're supposed to park.
I guess so.
Okay, let's check out this GMC Yukon. I've got it at 80 inches.
Yeah, there's a foot there that it parked into from the driver's side edge of the car to the line.
Honestly, it's kind of hard to blame them. I mean, if you're parking a big truck like this, because this is your car, and you see a van coming here, which is already going up over the yellow lines just to avoid us, you're not going to be trying to, you're going to try to get far away from those, I think.
Right. And I do see that the car in front of it is parked pretty far to the right, I think even in the buffer zone. Mm-hmm. So if it was trying to line up its right side with that car, I think it would be difficult.
Yeah, you know, the roadway, the width is a little narrower.
That's SFMTA project manager Peter Brown.
But for the most part, this isn't a place to be going really fast from A to B. This is a community park. It's a national institution. And having folks slow down if someone wants to parallel park, we think that's a good thing.
So he's saying people should slow down so they don't hit other people.
That individual may like it if they're getting their destination to 20 or 30 seconds faster, but for the overall community, it's probably not that big of an impact.
The bikeway has slowed traffic on JFK. For cars, about 2 or 3 miles per hour slower since the road was striped, according to a preliminary report from the SFMTA.
That makes sense. I mean, the thoroughfare is much more narrow now, and cars have to fully stop if anyone in front of them is trying to park.
Bike speeds have also dropped, from an average of 14.5 miles per hour to a little bit less than 13 miles per hour during the week, and even slower on weekends. And
the report suggests that's because bicyclists who used to cruise really fast up or down the park, they have to slow down now for other cyclists and the people who are trying to get across the bike lanes to their cars. Now, calming traffic was part of the point of this project, and it would, on paper anyway, make the park more accessible and safer.
And the MTA surveyed people who use the park, both before and shortly after the new stripes went in. Almost 90% of responders felt like they understood the striping, but only about 60% liked it. And some people I talked with, like Lita Ward, well, they didn't.
So it's really funny that you would ask, because I was just formulating a letter in my head while I was on my bike approaching you. Because I've had several incidents where I've nearly collided with people getting out of their cars that are crossing the bike lane into the sidewalk area. And I was screamed at by one man who was with his four-year-old daughter who stepped out into the bike lane, and it was really frightening. And obviously we can't stop quickly enough, and I think it's a great concept that, sorry, I'm a little out of breath because I was pedaling hard. It's a great concept, but drivers need to be aware of what that change means for bicyclists, because we are going 25, 30 miles per hour, and it's like stepping into ongoing traffic.
It didn't take us long wandering around JFK to see what she was talking about.
Whoa, well, so two teenagers were using the downhill slope. They were really kind of going fast as they went by me.
They did not stop at the stop sign there.
No, and they were kind of revving up the speed. They were on mountain bikes. And then I heard something. I turned around, and there was a pedestrian crossing the bike lane to get to his car, and he basically had to jump out of the way of these fast-going bicyclists.
Speedy bicyclists. That was definitely a close one. He looked startled for sure.
They both did. I mean, the kids obviously hadn't anticipated that issue, and neither had the pedestrian.
You know, I'm in favor of separate bikeways, so that's a good experiment to me. I've heard different people kvetching about it for various reasons, but I'm basically in favor of that.
That's Chris Carlson. He's a big-time bike advocate, co-founded the Critical Mass Ride 20 years ago. Now he runs Shaping San Francisco, which looks into ways to improve the city.
Part of it is the problem when you do those things in isolation like that, and there's no public campaign. Imagine if there was a full-blown public campaign with billboards and, you know, PSAs on all the stations saying, we're changing how the city works. There's now going to be bike lanes. You've got to get used to it. We're going to live this other way now, and there's going to be lots of room for safe cycling. And, you know, motorists have to learn that they're turning right across cycle paths. That's very different than what you've done before. Here's an educational booklet put on every doorstep. You know, a proper education campaign in conjunction with an infrastructural transformation, I think, could really be very successful.
All right, Ben, that was quite an examination.
Yeah, and there are other people who are still examining what works and what doesn't about the striping of Golden Gate Park. The SF Bike Coalition, they have a webpage devoted to the JFK Separated Bikeway Project. It shows a picture of four people biking down the lane, led by a child, right next to a car that's parked, yes, in the buffer zone.
Yeah, the page addresses some of the problems that we've been talking about. Cars that aren't parked where they're supposed to be, people crossing the bikeway without looking.
The SFMTA has a webpage called the JFK Cycle Track, and it includes a survey in which people can share their thoughts about what they like and what they don't like.
Well, I liked seeing here how that even with the imposed structure, people are making it work for them. I saw sporty bicyclists take the car lane to avoid slow biking tourists, pedestrians in the bike path to avoid sprinklers, and the cars driving through like they did before, only slightly slower.
Yeah, that part's all good, but they striped that park in the middle of last year, and more than half the cars still don't park right. I'm not sure it's ever going to work quite the way they imagined it.
That might just be part of the reality of the design process.
And it might be something we're going to have to get used to. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney.
And I'm Ray Sue Sussman.
So what do you think about the striping of Golden Gate Park? We'd like to hear your thoughts. Leave a message at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. And you might hear yourself on the air.
Broken bicycles, old busted chains, rusted handlebars out in the I must have an orphanage for all these things that nobody wants anymore.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Usually when you're on the road, using public transit, or traveling through airports, you're pretty much focused on getting where you want to go. You may not be paying attention to things like design. And then your flight is delayed over and over again. You get to know that airport really well, and you start to look around. In this episode of 99% Invisible, producer Roman Mars explores the world of airport design.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars.
Any passenger unattended will be removed and disposed of.
It can hardly be a coincidence that no language on Earth has ever produced the expression as pretty as an airport. Airports are ugly, some very ugly. Some attain a degree of ugliness that can only be the result of a special effort. This ugliness arises because airports are full of people who are tired, cross, and have just discovered that their luggage has landed in Murmansk. Murmansk Airport is the only exception of this otherwise infallible rule, and architects have, on the whole, tried to reflect this in their designs.
From Douglas Adams, The Long Dark Tea Time of the Soul.
I think so many airports were not designed for the things that they have to do right now. And so it is all fixing as you go. There wasn't some great master plan. So
when it comes to the ugliness and general dysfunction of airports,
they're a little bit off the hook.
A little bit off the hook, but there's plenty of room for improvement.
And once again, ladies and gentlemen, you have flight 1017.
When I spoke with Allison Arieff about the design of airports, she said to me, if all airports simply played Brian Eno's album Music for Airports over the speakers, every airport would be better.
My name is Allison Arieff, and I write about design and sustainability for the New York Times.
I say this to serve not only as an introduction to Allison Arieff, but also so that you'll know that she is someone whose judgment is perfectly true.
An architect I spoke to said, nothing is more quickly obsolete than an airport building. Like, the technology is changing so fast.
And the thing that all airports are still trying to catch up to now, the thing that forced airports to change the most, the fastest, was 9/11. Security screening has come to dominate all aspects of airport design, but we're going to focus on just two effects. The first is that because the unpredictability and time required to go through security, you no longer dawdle on what is called the land side of the airport.
Land side is basically the curb appeal part of the airport. Parking is still considered land side. The ticketing area is still considered land side. The wonderful lines that you have to wait in to TSA, which are also changing, by the way. Most airports, of course, have had to make room for those lines, so all of that is land side.
So once you wind yourself through the pleasant experience that is security, you are on the air side.
The people responsible for building airports really kind of followed the bus station model, where it was like a holding pen. We just got you here as long as we need to put you on Amtrak or put you on Greyhound. And airports were sort of on that model too, because the assumption was you were just passing through.
Now the assumption is that you are absolutely not just passing through. The assumption is that you are going to be staying a while. So newer airports are designed with that in mind. And a good example of this new thinking, described in a recent New York Times article by Arieff, is the new T2 terminal designed by Gensler Architects at San Francisco International Airport.
T2 is the new terminal for American Airlines and Virgin America at San Francisco International Airport. And it's one of the first terminals to be designed post 9/11.
The last terminal constructed before T2 at SFO was the International Terminal that opened in December of 2000. It still feels pretty new, but you can tell right away that the trajectory of airport design was going in a very different direction in the year 2000 than what is prioritized today.
San Francisco's main international terminal, for example, is all about the ticketing area. You walk in, it's just this massive amount of space.
It's open and airy and actually pretty wonderful to experience, but in the new world of TSA, all that building doesn't make any sense.
If you actually sit and think about it, you realize that all the exciting stuff is on the land side. You're eating, you're shopping, etc. All of that happens before security. In the new T2, all the good stuff is saved post-security because, as we all know, everyone's just rushing to their plane and they don't want to linger at all. So while there is a very generous, well-designed ticketing area, they've given way more square footage, like thousands and thousands of square feet, to what's called the airside, which is where the planes actually come into the gate.
What's also different about T2 is that they're really incorporating the security procedures in the design from the get-go. When you look at security now, it often looks like the TSA just set up shop yesterday with retractable barriers, and then it spits you out to a couple of folding chairs to put on your shoes and stow your laptop.
The new T2 actually has what they call a recompose zone, which is like a lounge for putting your clothes back on after you get through TSA, with, you know, some sculpture and lots of natural light and skylights. And once you are at that spot, putting your shoes and your belt and, you know, your jewelry and whatever else back on, you can see everything that you're about to enter into. Retail, gates, seating, all that sort of stuff.
I'd never given much thought to shops or restaurants and airports, but the thing I need, not want, what I need when I travel is a place to plug in my phone or laptop, and probably both.
There are many, many more banks of outlets. Because again, you think even back to pre-9/11, which is now just about 10 years ago, the ubiquity of personal technology was not, you know, there were Walkmans, right? They didn't need to get plugged in. Now everyone's got something at every age, every sort of traveling segment. So of course, older airports don't have enough.
I was in O'Hare recently, sitting on the floor next to this businessman, and we were huddled like hobos around a single outlet in this three-gate area.
Bravo Fox Pop, leveling 16,000.
According to ARIF, human factor studies shows that passengers want to stay within 250 feet of their gate, and T2 at SFO addresses this anxiety. If you're buying a paper, grabbing a coffee, sitting down at the restaurant, all of the gates are visible all the time because of the open floor plan.
What I heard a lot in talking to many, many architects about airports is that at the top of the list is letting people feel in control of their experience and having a sense of where they're going and really sort of designing so that all of the anxiety that comes naturally with that whole process now is alleviated to the greatest extent. And so a good sort of environments designer who can really intuit where people's hangups are going to be is key to a successful project.
The noble goal is to try to design away all airport anxieties, no matter how experienced the traveler. But who knows? In 10 years, I could be redoing this story and contrasting T2 against some new super airport that solves all the problems of usage that T2 failed to anticipate.
There's no place to park my jetpack. Fail.
For anything complex, perfect design is a moving target. But odds are your luggage will still be in Murmansk. 99% Invisible was produced this week by me, Roman Mars, with support from Lunar, making a difference with creativity. It's a project of KALW, 91.7 local public radio in San Francisco, the American Institute of Architects in San Francisco, and the Center for Architecture and Design. You can keep up with Allison Arieff at the Opinionator blog of the New York Times, and I should mention that the Douglas Adams quote at the top of the show was read by Francesca Panetta, who's the producer and creator of the Hackney podcast, which is consistently stunning and amazing, and you should subscribe. Although it does have a dearth of Francesca Panetta's voice in it. You probably heard more of her here than you'll ever hear on the Hackney podcast. Thank you, Fran. To find out more and get all kinds of links, go to the website. It's 99percentinvisible.org.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Panat Baba.
Next stop is Terminal 2.
Terminal 2 at the San Francisco International Airport, also called T2, has been praised for its modern design, which takes into account the needs of post-9/11 travelers.
Please hold on.
For instance, T2 has a comfortable recompose area where passengers can put their shoes and belts back on after passing through security. Most of the shops and restaurants are located within reach of the gates so that passengers can easily see their flight status. But there's something else that makes Terminal 2 special. Its art collection and the way travelers can experience it. KALW's RTM's Konahovs takes us on an audio art tour of Terminal 2.
I'm standing in the drop-off area outside San Francisco International Airport's Terminal 2. Above either side of the entrance stretch huge artworks of hand-painted glass. Bird wings on the left and airplane wings on the right. They're large, impressive. And if you call a number posted next to the front door, they are explained.
Welcome to SFO's Green Phone and Art Phone mobile tour. For the Art Phone, press 200 and a pound sign.
This artwork, Air Over Under, plays with our experience of flight. Seattle-based artist Nori Sato said that once we leave our standard point of reference, the ground, it can be hard to figure out where we are.
Depending on where we are in the air, we can be above the clouds, below the clouds, in no clouds, in the middle of clouds. And the image was constructed with that in mind.
there's some wonderful views out here sometimes when the seagulls actually are flying past the large seagull in the piece.
That's Susan Pontius.
My name is Susan Pontius. I'm the director of the Civic Art Collection and the Public Art Program for the San Francisco Arts Commission.
And she's with me because
we run the public art program in terms of the permanent acquisitions here at SFO.
We step inside the terminal to see another installation. It's two objects hanging from the ceiling on either side of the terminal entrance, right in the middle of the check-in area. Both look like they are made from different sized pieces of plastic.
These two pieces are called Topograph, and they are inspired in part by the topography of the Bay Area. But they also kind of remind me of clouds.
This piece, called Topograph, was made by Richmond, Virginia-based sculptor Kendall Buster. Here's the artist, Kendall Buster.
This wasn't a singular form, but they could be fragments as part of a larger hull that shifted apart the way tectonic plates, you know, might move. The notion is to create sort of two topographical maps, as it were, on either side of this area, and for the viewer to almost seem to be passing through these two topographical maps.
The artist very carefully considered the suspension mechanism as part of her aesthetic, and they very much are part of the aesthetic of this piece. They always remind me of like these upside-down rain clouds, so which are very appropriate on a day like today.
On the left, before the security gates, is a small lounge where one can wait for passengers who just arrived. Most of the walls are covered by artwork from Mark Adams, big red tapestries with bright flowers. It creates a cozy, living room-like atmosphere.
These are all Bay Area gardens, were the inspiration for them. And, you know, it is a technique and a craft that you don't see very much anymore. So I think that's one of the reasons that they are valuable to us, and they are just flat-out beautiful. I mean, sometimes you just say, it's just flat-out beautiful.
Near the lounge are a series of doors used by airport personnel to access the gates.
All right, come on in.
Okay.
We pass through into the recompose area, where people put their shoes and belts back on after the security check. The area is bright and airy, and home to an installation called Every Beating Second.
It is a spot where people kind of pause before then going on to their gates. And the inspiration for the artist was that this was a space that maybe you took a little bit of time to kind of look around you and notice some things.
Every beating second consists of three nets hanging down from the ceiling. Each one is a mixture of pink, purple, and blue. Looking closer, I can see they're moving a little bit, as if they're hovering in a breeze.
My name is Janet Eckelman. I'm a sculptor of public spaces using handcrafted and machine-crafted materials that respond to the environmental forces around us. I'm walking through security, and I look up, and I see there are three shapes cut through the roof, and you can see the sky, and coming down from the oculus at each of those points is a lace, brightly colored, netted form. And beneath you, in the floor, is a form that is the shadow of that lace shape above you.
So these pieces have become very dramatic, kind of signature pieces for the terminal. We see them showing up all the time in advertisements for T2.
You may not think of an airport as a place to see art or take an audio tour to learn more about its paintings and sculptures. People mostly come here for one reason, to travel. But the city of San Francisco spent nearly $2.5 million on artwork in Terminal 2. It's part of a city ordinance passed in 1969, which mandated that 2% of any construction costs be allocated to art enrichment or public art. As a result, San Francisco International Airport now has the most valuable public artwork collection in the city, outside its fine art museums.
Down, down, down. My name is Walter Katundu. I am a Bay Area artist and musician and instrument builder. And this is one of my first large-scale public commissions. It's called Bay Area Bird Encounters, and it's a photographic mural that's made up of many different kinds of woods, and it's 100% handmade and hand-built.
It's located near Gate 54.
The mural has images of birds that were photographs that I took over the last few years in the Bay Area. Just to the right of center, there's a large bird called a golden crown sparrow. And the wing feathers on that sparrow are playable, like a xylophone.
Yes, you can actually play music by hitting some parts of the wooden mural.
Go ahead, try it.
Yeah, just start hitting it.
In other spaces, wooden artwork can get damaged by vandals carrying sharp implements, knives for instance. This makes the airport a good venue.
Because as we know, no one has knives here, right? So this is kind of a media that we typically could not put in a public area.
Attention concourse, Virgin America flight 908 to Las Vegas.
So next time, if you have some time to spend waiting for your flight, take a moment and look around. You can enjoy one of the San Francisco's newest, most sophisticated, and expensive art galleries. It's arrived at Terminal 2.
Some of the most exemplary works in the collection can be found here at SFO.
In San Francisco International Airport, I'm Artem Skonohaus for Cross Currents.
We'd like to hear about your favorite airports worldwide. Which ones are most pleasing to your eye? Share them on our Facebook page. It's KALW News.
You want to know the secret to surviving air travel? After you get where you're going, take off your shoes and your socks. Then you walk around on the rug barefoot and make fists with your toes.
Fist with your toes.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. And now we've arrived at a relatively new destination for us here at KALW. It sounds like this. All week long, the station has been playing you this sound.
Run!
It's part of our new project, Audiograph, in which we record sounds from around the bay, the signature sounds of our area. We then ask you what it is and where in the Bay Area it's from. Ready for the answer?
My name is Miller, Herman Miller. Everybody know me as Miller the Champ. We're at Golden Gate Fields in Albany, California. I come out probably only on the weekend once, three times a month. You know, bring about $100 to try to win.
And running on Lakers, paid to that.
I pay the horses, but I take it very serious. You know, horses are glorious animals. I mean, of course, they say cheetahs run the fastest, but horses also is very fast. And of course, this is like the king sport, you know. So it's really fun, especially when you win. You get excited.
A number of you called in and got it right.
The Audiograph, we believe, is Golden Gate Fields, the starting of the race and the onlookers cheering on their chosen steed.
Run!
But today's winner of a KALW baseball cap is
Susan Stone.
Congratulations, Susan. And we'll have a new sound for you to guess next week. In the meantime, visit our Facebook page, KALW News, to hear more from Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. And that does it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Julie Kane, Audrey Dilling, Panina Eilberg-Schwartz, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Alyssa Kapnick, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Erica Moo, Stephen Short, RJ Sloan, Eva Sonsin, Anna Sterling, Christine Stolakis, Adam Teitelbaum, and Mary Willis. Today's show is engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Van Treffney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. Thanks to City Car Share, which provides an alternative transportation option for our reporters. They're online at citycarshare.org. And thank you. We are listener-supported radio.
Run!
The music you're hearing is by Solstice, a female vocal ensemble you may have heard on the KALW program Folk Music and Beyond. Well, you can see them live on Sunday evening when they play at the Episcopal Church of St. Mary the Virgin in San Francisco. Details are at KALW.org. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
Oh, let me sail away. Song for you, ink of a pill. Wow. Underneath the skin, an empty space to fill.
Tune into Cross Currents weekdays at 5. We've got action.
He's hoisted up by his ankles and hung upside down from a building.
Suspense.
I don't know if you heard that, but we actually just heard a smoke detector battery beep.
Romance.
Jerry, who I've been hanging out with, is my lover.
And style.
The key to his outfit is a pair of homemade AstroTurf armbands.
Kind of like so. That's my trademark, is the AstroTurf.
Not enough? We've also got penguins. Politicians.
Don't be economic, girly man.
Medical mysteries.
You would give me a pat on my belly?
Yeah, you know, protect those ovaries.
And of course, music.
Music?
Music!
Music.
Where's the music?
All that in one show. It's Cross Currents, weekdays at 5 on KALW.